If you look in your program guide, you'll see that almost all the names on this panel have changed. On Monday, Mitch Ratcliffe, the original moderator, was forced to cancel. On Tuesday, we lost Bill Burrington, and on Wednesday, we lost Ron Flesser. I think the acid test for any conference is whether the audience is as interesting as the panelists, and I think this panel shows that CFP passes that test because everyone here was recruited at the last minute, except for Brian Eck. This morning, we're going to talk about the future of Internet service providers with five people. Ed Cavazos, who's an attorney with Andrews and Kurth, specializing in ISP-related issues and co-author of Cyberspace and the Law. Brian Eck, who's Vice President of Government Relations for Prodigy. Bruce Fancher, who's founder and president of Mindbox, a large New York-based ISP. Simpson Garfinkel, who most of you probably know is author of the Unix Security Handbook and founder of Vineyard.net, an ISP on Martha's Vineyard. And Daniel Dern, author of the Internet Guide for New Users. My name's Jeff Uboys. I'll be moderating the panel. We'll all speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll take some questions from the floor. The first CFP was partly inspired by a massive series of federal raids called Operation Sun Devil. And some of the most ill-considered of those raids were against small, independent bulletin board owners and operators who had the misfortune to host what federal law enforcement officials believed to be inappropriate or illegal content. Issues first raised at that time, such as liability for content posted by users, common carriage, local law enforcement operating on global networks, and numerous First Amendment issues are still very much with us today. Board operators then and ISP operators now serve as places of assembly, as publishers, and common carriers, then we all have a stake in their business beyond our basic net connections. Unfortunately, things are not dramatically different in the environment today. The Communications Decency Act, new taxation schemes, and services such as voice on the net are making the operation of an ISP even more complex from a legal point of view. If the copyright bill pending passes, ISPs will be strictly liable for copyright violation by their users. Our legal metaphors for ISPs are broken. We don't know whether ISPs are simply common carriers, like the phone companies, not responsible users, publishers protected by the First Amendment but liable for user comments, or new draftees in the war on copyright violators and child pornographers. In short, it seems that ISPs face the legal liabilities of both publishers and companies without the full protections afforded traditionally to either role. The business side of being an ISP isn't getting any easier either. IP dial tone is fast becoming a commodity, and everyone, it seems, wants to get into the ISP business. AT&T, MCI, IBM, Microsoft, the Bell companies, the cable industry, the online industry, and maybe the newspapers and electric utilities are all entering this market. All of these companies have deep pockets, and they all seem intent on buying the market rather than on turning a profit. AT&T is promising free access, and I don't know about you, but I haven't had to buy any floppy disks in a long time. Maybe we all ought to give a hearty thanks to Steve Case. ISPs have some weaknesses in comparison to these new competitors, as you might expect. The big telecom companies can bundle their existing voice and data services with internet access. And the big software companies like Microsoft, their offerings with 90% of the PCs sold in the US today. The big players can also provide nationwide access, and that's important to people who travel, and they can cut more favorable deals with content providers. A more serious problem in the long run may be access to capital. Even UUNET has seen its stock price fall from nearly 100 to about 25 and was recently forced to cancel a planned share offering. Finally, smaller ISPs are vulnerable to costs imposed by government regulation crafted by large telecom firms. The long-distance industry's recent petition against voice on the net isn't the first and won't be the last attempt to simply outlaw the competition. If you want a really dark analogy, think of the small computer firms of the 1980s, or retailers, rather, of the 1980s, that hoped to survive the arrival of CompUSA and the mail-order business. They've all but disappeared. Or think of K-Pro, Osborne, and Morrow Designs, once big names in the personal computer industry that were killed by scaling problems and the commoditization of their business. Despite these problems, there are some good reasons to hope for continued diversity. While the big corporate accounts may go to big providers, and the mass market may go to consumer services, power users and small businesses, for now, will continue to be better served by ISPs, as will many communities of interest, rural users, and customers that need some additional consulting. There are also some hidden strengths, I think, that ISPs have, and these their big competitors can't match. For example, they can work together, they can share technical solutions, and they can adapt to new conditions far more quickly. Basically, they've got a culture of openness going for them. If you're a budding ISP, you can go to www.amazing.com and you can get some high-quality handholding from more experienced providers. We all like to think we're on the cutting edge and that nothing like this new world has ever happened before, but I think some historical analogies are useful. The fact is, small players can survive in the conduit business. There are still nearly 1,200 independent local telephone companies in this country, as well as numerous radio stations and electric cooperatives. Simpson here is running a model of that kind of business. There are a couple possible futures on the publishing side of the ISP business. The grim one is that of the small town newspaper. These, as you know, have been largely gobbled up by big chains. The other possibility, which I believe we'll see, is the emergence of many small publishers who can use ISPs as content distribution channels. In sum, I think the ISPs are a good barometer or indicator or warning light for the kind of information environment we're living in. Rather like the canaries brought down into the mines to warn people of bad air, I think we can look to the health or sickness of ISPs to warn us about media concentration, inappropriate government control of publishing and content, and our freedom to assemble and form communities of interest. Thank you, and I'll let Ed Cavazos speak.
Thanks, Jeff. I think that Jeff's focus on the metaphor, at least from the legal perspective, is the right focus because, as we've heard, I think, in a lot of the other presentations this week, the focus on metaphor is where it boils down, where the lawyers and the legislators find themselves. And that's no accident because our legal system embodies the notion that you react to precedent. And when you have something like an ISP appear on the scene, you don't have the precedent that deals with that particular beast. And so you start asking questions that sound very familiar to you if you've been here this week. Like, what are they? What do we do? What are they more like telephone than they are like print? Are they more like television than they are radio? Or are they something completely new? ISPs are, as in, business entities are facing this challenge, identity challenge right now. And I think that it's interesting to note that, as we will hear, I'm sure, from some of the panelists, that ISPs aren't stagnant. They're not a business model that's been set up and is now out there working. They evolve by necessity because the technology evolves. They're a different beast than they were a couple years ago when you logged onto your ISP and had a shell account. A lot more of the data was sitting on the server. Now they're slipping PPP accounts, and a lot less data sits on the server, passes right through it. That's a different service in some respects, and it may call for a different metaphor. And since ISPs adapt with the technology, they may be moving towards one metaphor or another, and I think that it's not just the technology that will make them do that. I think that it's some pressures, regulatory and legal, are the ones I'm going to focus on, and I think we'll hear more about some of the economic pressures that may move them into one cubbyhole or another. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what's happening in my neck of the woods down in Texas as an example of how that is playing out. Just under a year ago, Texas passed its version of telecommunications reform in the Public Utilities Regulatory Act, a fairly broad-reaching, sweeping reform of the telecommunication industry in Texas. And very late in that process, the NET community opened its eyes and said, I wonder if anything those guys are doing to the phone companies and the wireless folks might affect what we're doing. And that was kind of a, all of a sudden, that realization that this thing might affect ISPs and bulletin board services and online services dawned on everyone at once. In an amazingly effective grassroots type effort, and we don't have a VTW focusing on Texas issues. In fact, very few states have something like that where someone's watching the developments in the legislature, in the state legislature. But in an amazingly effective grassroots organization, the ISPs and EFF Austin and EF Houston and the ISDN Users Group and a whole bunch of other small nonprofits and industry type groups got together and convinced the legislature to throw a line in the statute that says nothing in this statute is intended to regulate the rates of or impose a tax on BBSs or internet service providers. And it says that in clear language in the statute. That's a pretty significant development in that, to my knowledge, it's the first time BBSs and ISPs are specifically expressly addressed in telecommunication reform. Well, it's a good thing, but it's kind of a bad thing, too, because we always kind of thought that maybe they didn't need to be addressed. And the fact that there's even a question as to whether they are addressed or not shows is a barometer of changing times, I think. Of course, as with anything that gets added into a telecommunication reform bill, this thing had to go through this line, this section had to go through the phone companies, who, like the legislators, kind of gave us a response of, we know, why are you bugging us? We've got a lot more important stuff to talk about. But that wasn't completely the response, because the other part of the response was, and why don't you tag on to that exception, an exception to the exception, which says this is fine as long as you're in the information services or enhanced services game, but not the telecommunication services game. We don't want small phone companies kind of restructuring themselves to look like an ISP or BBS and avoiding the regulatory regime or the taxes or what have you. And that sounded like the best the ISPs and the BBSs could get, so they agreed to that. Less than 1 year later, the state comptroller's office in Texas in the last 3 weeks has taken the position that that exemption means absolutely nothing, that the exemption is read out of existence. And some of my ISP clients asked me to go ask them why, and the answer is this. ISPs and BBSs, according to their perspective, are telecommunication services. And maybe they weren't when this thing was passed, but to the extent that the exception to the exception says you get the break as long as you're not in the telecommunication game, the exception doesn't mean anything at all. Why do they feel that? Well, it's a combination of factors. It's internet voice technologies, which make them think that these things look a lot more like phone companies than they ever did before. It's the notion that a lot of ISPs are purely in the access business, and they see that as somehow different than the information business. They recognize that if you're a true content provider, you're probably not subject to the regulation. But what that means in the age of SLIP and PPP is not clear. Are you the content provider if what you're doing is allowing someone to get to the content? You're not, according to the comptroller of the state of Texas. What that means for ISPs is you have to restructure your model in order to lose the chance or decrease the chance that you're going to get sucked into the regulatory regime. And so you have to look at ways to posture yourself as a content provider. But as all of us who have been following these things know, as you move towards that different metaphor, the editor or the publisher, you get a host of other problems that come along with that. You get the possibility that you're going to be viewed as the way a newspaper is for purposes of defamation. I think Brian can tell us some about how that battle is played out. You get the copyright question. The more you integrate yourself into what people are getting through your system, the more you look like a contributory infringer if those people infringe. And certainly the white paper and pending legislation wants to make that more so. You get the problem, I think, that the CDA represents. The CDA says, oh, as long as if you're in the access, making it possible for someone to get there is not it, it's got to be the guy making it. Well, the more you move towards content, the more it looks like the CDA may mess with you. You have problems we haven't seen yet that will emerge. The first time someone is hurt by material going through your system in a way that doesn't involve defamation or copyright or smut, we're going to see efforts to develop that legal doctrine into putting accountability in the only place where a lot of people think you can put the accountability. It's on the service provider, because the users, for all we know, don't even exist. They're anonymous or something. I want to close what I'm saying, and I think you'll hear the rest of the folks talk about how these forces are playing out. But I want to close by saying this. Get back to the notion of metaphor as the way to address these problems. It's an instinctive response by our legal system, as I said earlier, to try to cubbyhole people like ISPs into one area or another. That's the way it works in the law. It's not necessarily the way it should work, and in fact, it's not necessarily the way it has to work. And I think that there are lots of good reasons why perhaps we shouldn't fall into the trap of saying, is it more like print or is it more like television or radio? or common carrier, because it's not any of those. The only thing we know for sure is that it's not print, and it's not radio, and it's not common carrier. We know that, and the whole analysis of fitting the services that ISPs offer into the metaphor may be a faulty one to begin with. Real briefly, there's examples that you can point to in the defamation context, for example. ISPs offer something into the defamation scenario that, or online services and ISPs do, that it wasn't there before. The inherent right of the defamed party to reply to the person who defamed them. And we don't have that in print. In fact, we have a Supreme Court case that says it would be illegal to force newspapers to do that. We don't have that in television anymore. We had it for a little bit in the form of the Fairness Doctrine. That's a new thing, and online services are more than happy, or ISPs, to give access to someone who wants to defend their reputation if it would act as a shield from defamation liability for the service provider. Recognizing those unique and inherent characteristics of this new media that don't fit any of the pre-existing metaphors may be the way out of this conflation of forces that are forcing ISPs to kind of pick between one bad option and another not so bad option. And I think that that's what we're going to see more of in the next few years.
My name is Brian Eck, and I'm Vice President of Public Affairs for Prodigy Services Company. In coming here today, there is so much historic irony going on right now in our industry. We have the Communications Decency Act lawsuit arguing for free speech taking place in Philadelphia. There's something else coming down the road in the area of copyright, and I'm very aware of comments that we received from the internet community as the telecom bill became the Telecom Act, and the message was, if we had only known about this before it happened. Well, I'm going to tell you about some other things happening today in the area of copyright, and again, with historic irony, perhaps in Boston with Paul Revere and the swinging of the lantern in North Church. If all I can do today is make you aware of something else that's coming, just to raise your awareness, I'll be very pleased with having been able to do that. Growing up in the Boston area, my parents said that they wanted me to be a responsible adult. I didn't realize just how responsible I was going to become. I have a family, a mortgage, kids, and college payments coming up, pretty big responsibilities. And then I became an online service provider. And within the past few months, it seems I've taken on a number of more responsibilities. I'm responsible for keeping everyone's kids away from indecent content. I'm responsible for maintaining community standards for thousands of communities across the country, whether that be New York City, Boston, or Salt Lake City. I'm responsible for keeping potentially libelous comments from digitally reaching the public's ears. I'm responsible for keeping infringing content off of my service and off of the internet. I'm responsible for protecting consumers from falling victim to online scams. I'm responsible for making sure that no one messes with a consumer's cyberspace privacy. And ironically, the only one responsible for keeping this whole big picture straight is me. It seems today that whether you're an online service provider, an internet access provider, a bulletin board operator, or a website owner, you are truly your brother's keeper. You're also his parent, his kid's parent, his financial advisor, his copyright lawyer, and his personal policeman. At least that's what some people expect of all of us. Now, unfortunately, in today's society, responsibility equals liability. Fail to do all of those things that we just discussed, and you might find yourself facing a $200 million lawsuit. You may find yourself facing 2 years in the slammer. I've got to tell you, it sure doused my desire to be a CEO. Now, the big question today for the online service providers and the internet access providers, and for you folks, is who's liable for what's out there on the internet? And exactly what are you liable for? Now, the short answer is, we don't know for sure. Unfortunately, the landscape is an absolute mess, and the trail signs all point in different directions. Today, I'm going to give you some opinions, but I also want to make it clear that I am not a lawyer. I'm an online operator. So in the end, my opinions may be worthless, but I hope not. I think part of the confusion out there stems from the fact that internet and the online services environment is really such an amalgam. In talking to a congressman, he said, you know, he said, your industry, he said, it's like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. You're everything and you're nothing all at the same time. And my response was, that's the point. We're publishers. We create content and we put it on the commercial services and on the web. We're the post office, delivering millions of email letters every day. We're the telephone company, linking people up in real-time chat, in instant messaging, with real-time voice coming on strong. We're the town square, allowing people to voice their opinions in free-flowing debate on bulletin boards. We're also a library or a bookstore, assembling interesting internet content by subject, connecting content through hyperlinks, which I like to call the internet's Dewey Decimal System. And then we're straight pipe, linking individuals straight out to the internet. Now the problem comes in when people don't understand this existence of multiple roles, and they try to assign the wrong one to a particular function. Or worse yet, they put their own definition on us, as we saw happen in the telecom legislation. In a way, this is really a case of mistaken identity, and I personally feel like an online version of The Fugitive. One of the clearest examples of mistaken identity that's taken place is Stratton Oakmont. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, this was a Long Island investment firm that sued Prodigy for $200 million for potentially libelous comments posted on one of our bulletin boards. Stratton Oakmont claimed that we were a publisher in the case of that board, and we should have been responsible for what third parties say. That case went to court. It's been appealed. Unfortunately, I have to tell you that while Prodigy did not pay a penny, the judge agreed. We're publishers. Unfortunately, this wrong-headed coulda, shoulda concept will pop up again as we enter the copyright debate. Then you've got the Communications Decency Act. Congress bought an image, hook, line, and sinker, of online and internet operators as TV networks with full control over their programming. After all, they're both screens, right? Computer screen, TV screen, it's the same thing. The only problem is, not only does that analogy not work, but no one knows for sure what indecency is or what are those good faith efforts that the online operators have to take to screen such information from minors. And the most important question of all, what happens to free speech? Now, the same scenario is playing out again in the copyright arena, where the online and internet operators are seen as publishers, and the same thing goes for website owners, with the ability and the responsibility to police your boards, to police the net, and to pull down links and content containing infringing material. There are major publishers out there today that are arguing before Congress that every online provider, every web page creator should be required in advance to check out the copyright status of every piece of material that is contained behind a hyperlink that you create. Folks, I got to tell you, if that stands, the navigational infrastructure of the internet comes down in a heartbeat, and that's something that we absolutely can't allow to happen. Now, ultimately, I think that the liability landscape is going to work out in the following ways. The Communications Decency Act did do one positive thing, and I kind of hesitate to say that in this group, but it did. There was a Good Samaritan provision put in that basically said that any online or internet operator who makes a good faith effort to remove truly egregious material from a board cannot be held liable for libelous content or defamatory content put up on their service. So the Stratton-Oakmont decision now, because of the federal law, is moot. I'm optimistic that the Philadelphia lawsuit is going to toss the CDA right back to the legislators. And from there, I think you'll see two things. I think the statute will have to be narrowed to something that is workable for this group, something that protects free speech, potentially a harmful to minors definition. And I also think there's going to be a PICS-type defense, an access control defense, like what's being developed from MIT, where if you're a website owner and you're offering adult content, if you label that, you should be off the hook. You should be allowed to have that content up on the internet. Copyright, I think, though, is going to be the real wild card. Extending copyright protection to the transmission of digitized information, I think, creates some real problems. And unfortunately, the court cases out there, when it comes to the liability of the actual operators, go in all different directions. But when the smoke clears, I think you're going to see a process through which copyright owners will be able to report infringing material to online operators, internet access providers, and website owners. I do think that we will be required to remove content or to disable links in a prompt manner. I do think that we will all be required to educate our users on respect for copyright and intellectual property. But the real issue is hyperlinking, whether or not this constitutes, with the publisher's view, as contributory infringement, because you have taken content that's out on the internet and somehow pointed to it or made more users aware of it, and therefore if there's infringing content behind it, the view is that you should be liable. I absolutely disagree with this. I view this in the same situation as if I were to drive into your neighborhood, break into your house, and steal your television set. It would be as if the police went out and arrested the local Ford dealer and said that if there were no cars out on the street, then there would be no burglary. I don't think we should be required to do any pre-checking of content. I think that will take down the very infrastructure of the internet. This is something that we're going to be fighting very hard. It's something that you need to be aware of, and you need to be participators in this process. Now, when it comes time for copyright to be decided in a court, unfortunately, I do believe that everyone involved is going to go for the deepest pockets. I do think that the prevailing view of some of the straight internet access providers, that they are mere conduits and they will not be held liable, I think it's a pipe dream, because most, if not all, of those internet providers offer some kind of a front end through a browser or whatever that does make selective editorial judgments as far as what's cool or what's new or what's hot out on the internet. And I do believe that when the lawsuit time comes, the internet access providers are going to be squarely in the middle. The good news is I don't see any copyright legislation coming out of Congress this year. And I've seen some other positive developments. This week, Congress established a special Internet Caucus where several congressmen have gotten together and they have pledged to take their laptops and go out and address the issue and educate other members of Congress, getting them online. I thought it was amazing that in the House of Representatives today, can you believe that only 25% of the representatives have email addresses? It's astounding. But that's what we're dealing with. There is a lot happening in this industry. There's a lot happening quickly. We all need to get involved and address the issues. And I think if in any industry, it can certainly be said in ours, we definitely live in interesting times. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. I'm Bruce Bancher. I run an ISP in New York called MindVox for about the past 4 years or so. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Basically, I got into the ISP business sort of by accident. Our original intention when we started MindVox was to really just run a bulletin board system. And we're going to offer internet access as a sort of extra service because we figured there were probably a few hardcore techies in New York that we could sell that to. And we really had no idea that it was going to become the mainstream phenomenon which it's become. It was actually virtually impossible to tell somebody new that I met 3 or 4 years ago what line of work I was in without getting in a 15 or 20 minute conversation and detailed explanation, because of course nobody knew what I was talking about. But basically, based on that experience, I want to make a sort of few observations, one of which is that the ISP business is actually really a terrible business, and it's sort of funny that there's actually about 3,500 ISPs in the United States right now, which means that there's a lot of misery spread around. I used to sort of drink my coffee with milk and sugar. First the sugar went, then the milk. Now it's basically just, 3 or 4 black cups of coffee before 9 a.m. A lot of cigarettes and such. Thank you. Part of the problem with the business is there's really no solutions that are standard. It's not like medicine or manufacturing or insurance, where you can sort of buy off-the-shelf software packages and do a little bit of customization and expect to have a actually working solution. Basically, every ISP that I'm aware of is held together with baling wire and spit. I know there's an ISP with about 10 times as many customers as we have in New York, there's another one, and several. And I spoke to one of their system administrators the other day, because he used to work for us, and it was actually sort of reassuring to find that they were going through many of the same technical troubles that we were, because there's actually, it's very difficult to scale these solutions upwards. The other aspect of the business is that it's continuously changing, and it's becoming more and more differentiated in the sense that every day people are thinking of new uses for service. People used to ask us if I would field a sales call for, say, web hosting, pretty much, what are your rates and how much disk space do you have? Now people ask, do we have multiple T1s? Is there a redundant connection? Do you have a real audio server, a VDO, CGI support, disk space, traffic costs, log analysis tools? Can I have my own domain name? Now I have email to and from my own domain name, FTP, mailing list, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think what that lends itself to is, unlike the telephone industry, where basically every customer got the same thing, which is a dial tone, this is going to become increasingly differentiated. And I don't think that on that basis, it's fairly clear that there are not going to be any monopolies in this industry. And as a result, I don't think that traditional regulatory models that we've had for the telephone industry apply. In particular, I'm sort of disturbed by the fact that I think 3 or 4 years ago at the first CFP it was very exhilarating because there were a lot of sort of luminaries and visionaries talking about the potential for a national information infrastructure, and a lot of talk of the potential for sort of business and activism and public discourse, and people were very concerned that everyone was sort of sure that this thing was going to be built at some point in the future. They seemed to be sure that what was going to be built was not, in fact, the internet. And there seemed to be a lot of people talking about the properties of this coming infrastructure. And I have one of the sort of better recommendations was the EFF's Open Platform Initiative, which I have here, which specifically specified that the properties you would want out of such a network were diversity of information sources, universal access, free speech and common carriage, privacy, and develop with public interest applications and services. Of course, in the meantime, the internet just sort of happened, and we have pretty much all those things in one form or another. And I think what we should learn from that is that the telecommunications industry is very different than it was. And we should not, in fact, we shouldn't try and regulate it. We shouldn't, it's not a question of whether the FCC should have jurisdiction over the internet. It's a question of should there be an FCC, and the answer is clearly no. I believe that the CDA is actually a red herring. People are really up in arms about it. And the fact of the matter is, a number of people are going to, if it remains, a number of innocent people are going to get harassed or put in jail or fined. But I don't think that the long-term effect of the CDA is going to be as significant as much as a threat to free speech as the notion that we should actually have economic regulation of telecommunications. The current telecommunications bill, I have a copy of it, I haven't actually read through it, but this doesn't look like a deregulation bill. I mean, this is huge. It's got sections on pole attachments and technology funds, and virtually everything is covered. A real technology deregulation bill should be about a page. So basically, I think that's pretty much, all that I have to cover. Thank you.
I need a glass of water first. Okay. After that. There you go, Dan. Thank you. Hi. My name is Simpson Garfinkel, and I'm a journalist. But last year I decided to move to Martha's Vineyard. And there wasn't really an internet service provider on Martha's Vineyard, and since I write about the internet, this posed a problem. So I decided to get my own frame relay connection and put it in my basement. And turned out that the total cost in that would be about $200, $300 a month. And I was writing a book about computer security, so that seemed like a cool way to get some experience. And then we had this idea that we could subsidize, actually it was $400 a month, we decided that we could subsidize the cost of that by setting up a small ISP and selling some of the service on the side and paying our costs. Well, what happened was, we just heard, it turns out that there is no off-the-shelf software. Well, I knew that. And so I figured I'd write some Perl scripts to do some billing and write some software that would let people create accounts. And this would sort of take 5 or 6 hours a week. Well, it did take about 40 hours a week. And most of those hours were around 6 p.m. till 2 a.m. We actually have about 300 customers now. We have a full-time employee who isn't paid. But he does get health insurance, which I think is really important. Now, I want to take a survey of the audience here. VineyardNet is your standard internet service provider. We have 20 dial-up lines. We have connections to the internet. We actually have redundant connections that go to the same place. And we have some web service. Now, who thinks that we are actually a telecommunications provider? Put up your hands. Okay. And who thinks that we're not? Okay, so most of you don't know. Well, we called up the State Department of Revenue and asked them if we were a telecommunications provider, because it turns out if we are, we have to charge sales tax. And if we aren't, we don't have to charge sales tax, but if we are supposed to be charging sales tax and we don't, we're liable for the amount of money that we didn't collect and penalties. And if we are collecting sales tax and we're not supposed to, we're still liable for the amount of money that we've collected, but we have to give it back to our users. I think that we're also liable for penalties. So the Department of Revenue told us that we were an internet service provider. They told us that we were a telecommunications provider. And then we thought that that was a problem, because it turns out that there is another internet service provider on Martha's Vineyard, and they don't charge sales tax. So this would put us at a competitive disadvantage, not because our service would be more expensive, but because people would object to seeing the word sales tax on their bill, and they would think that we were trying to screw them. We then called the Department of Revenue again, and we were told that we were not a telecommunications provider, and they refused to give us an opinion in writing. So we're currently not charging sales tax. It turns out that the less you charge for something, the more people want. And this was something I sort of knew, but it's really true. And anybody who's ever done computer consulting knows this. If you go out and you charge people $20 an hour, they really want you to do a lot of stuff. But if you charge people $100 an hour, they're very thrilled with whatever you do. And they feel better about paying you more money. This is why it's really bad when all these high school kids go out and do computer consulting. They should stay in school. What we discovered was that the more services we offered, and as we lowered the prices, people in fact wanted more services, and they started arguing about 50-cent charges on their bills because they were told that there was this flat fee. We've actually started raising our prices in response to this, and the more we charge, the happier people are with the service. Unfortunately, we can't charge enough, and the reason for this is that there are basically a lot of people, a lot of companies, they're coming into the internet business now, and their model is to give away their product or their service and capture market share, and then they'll get rich. The problem, though, is that people are getting accustomed to getting things for free. So what happens is that when they want to start charging for something, another company comes in and starts giving away their product or service or subsidizing it with venture capital or bank loans or a sweat. And nobody ever gets the payoff. So I'm predicting right now that we're going to see a big crash in all these internet businesses come this October. And unfortunately, it's probably going to trigger a stock market crash as well. So take your money out in September. Something that techies don't understand, a lot of these internet companies, that I actually write about internet companies, so you might think that running VineyardNet is a conflict of interest. It probably is, and it would be a bigger conflict of interest if we actually made money on it. But one of the things that techies learn when they get into business is that most of the things that you have to do running a business have very little to do with the technology that you're actually trying to push. A lot of it has to do with the difficulty of setting up health insurance and bank accounts and dealing with money and all the mechanics of running business. And that's why most companies with good technology fail. I'd like to share an experience that I had with one of my problem customers. And then I'm going to pass along to Mr. Dern because I've talked already too long. We did not want to offer NetNews to our users. And there are basically many reasons for that. The first reason is that I stopped reading NetNews in 1986 because there was too much trash on it. And I just couldn't keep up with it all. Back in the early 80s, was anybody here on Usenet in 1983, 84? Right. So you guys all know that at that time you could actually read all of Usenet. And then around 1985 you couldn't anymore. And none of the groups were any good anymore. Usenet has this fundamental scaling problem, which is it's really good to be involved in an online service such as a bulletin board where there are about 1,000 people, and they all have different levels of skill, and there's some people who've been there a while and some new people. That's an interesting community. And as Usenet has gotten bigger and bigger, instead of having more and more of these small communities be created, it's just gotten bigger and bigger, and the approach of Usenet has been to split by very fine subject area instead of splitting by geographical area or just by like item number. So we see, you know, this dot this dot this dot this dot this with 10,000 people who all are exactly the same level of animosity towards each other. The real reason I didn't want to run Usenet, though, aside from all the legal reasons and the time-wasting reasons and the bandwidth-wasting reasons, it takes more than a 56K feed to get a full Usenet feed, is because the software is not very reliable, and it is always breaking, and there is 10 gigabytes coming in every other day, and it's very, very personnel intensive. So we had a pointer. Our machine news.vineyard.net was actually another company that was off island that let us read news on their machine. And people complained that it was too slow. You see, the more you give people, the more they complain. The phone company has a very good model, which is they give the same service to everybody. And so we were finally pressured into getting our own news server, which is still a mistake. And we decided not to bring down the binary groups. And the reason we didn't want to do that was because we didn't want all the child porn on our machines. But the real reason we gave for doing it was that the binary groups account for more than half the traffic of Usenet, and it would have completely ruined our entire connection. So we had news.vineyard.net being our local machine, and we had news.vineyard.net being the same machine that was off-island. And we told the three people that we knew who wanted Usenet that this change had happened. They actually sent mail to everybody, and that they could still get the full news feed off-island. Well, the next thing that happens is I get this really nasty email from one of our users who I will call Mickey. And Mickey says, one second. Mickey says, I can't get at my Doom binaries anymore. I'm really angry. And so we're not really sure what he's talking about, but we say that you can just go to news-full. The next thing that happens is I get a phone call from the island newspaper saying, we hear that you're now censoring the Usenet. And I go through a very long discussion with him, wasting about an hour and a half of my time, explaining that we've moved our machine and that it's now on island and the guy can still get it, and if he just gives me the name of the person who called, I know who called, then I'd be very happy to tell him how to set up his machine properly. Well, what happens is that the newspaper runs an article saying that we are censoring the Usenet. Now, the article itself doesn't say that, but the headline says that. It says, Island Internet Service Provider Censors Internet. And what happened was that this user started then posting highly pornographic messages to Usenet news groups that were not for the carriage of pornography, but basically posting them to the talk groups instead of the all binaries groups. And we started getting complaints from people who were off island that we had a problem user. And these pictures could actually be considered obscene under the law. So we made copies of these images, further breaking the law. And then we proceeded to call the user up and inform him that he had been, people off island had been complaining that he had been posting to this public area. We actually left the message on his answering machine. We did that intentionally so other people and his family might hear it. That's really nasty, you know. But we weren't violating his privacy because they were publicly posted. He canceled his account. He's now using Prodigy. No problem. I mean, you have lots of problem users. It's what happens when you're the nation's third largest provider. Or second. I don't keep track. But this is all just really nasty stuff. And, you know, all I ever wanted was my own little internet connection. And maybe to do a public service. So it's just a big quagmire. I was really hoping when AT&T came in that we would be able to get out of business and say, okay, everybody, AT&T is now giving free internet service with the phone service. We are going out of business, and you can go through them. It turns out we can't do that because AT&T, bless their souls, are not giving free internet service to anybody. You have to be in a major metropolitan area. They are lying in their advertisements. You only get to use the 800 number if you go with the metered service. So, as is the case with Prodigy and CompuServe and America Online, the rural area in which I live continues to be left out because we can't place local phone calls to your modem banks. So I still have to be running this crazy modem bank, which has the modems flaking out every other day. And I am looking forward to the day when people on Martha's Vineyard can make phone calls 7 miles across the water to Woods Hole, where there is a CompuServe modem bank. But it's not clear that that's going to happen anytime soon. And even if it does happen, now that people on the island are used to having an internet service provider, it's not clear that they will let us go out of business. If anyone has any suggestions, I'd be happy to hear them. The last thing I'm going to say, because I've already talked too long, is that the economics of this business really suck. I don't think you explained how much they suck, but let me give you an idea of how much it costs to get a new phone line in. There's a $50 install fee. The modem costs $400 because rack modems cost more than regular modems. If you use regular modems, you're really asking for trouble. They don't work. when you leave them turned on 24 hours a day. And then you have to get a port on your router or your terminal concentrator before you even count the cost of your personnel time to install and configure the equipment. You end up between $1,000 and $1,500 cost per line, right? Yeah, they're nodding. I mean, they can't tell exactly what their cost is because that's a proprietary, confidential, economic thing, but we're very open with our numbers because they suck. And so this line can hold about 10 customers, and then you have to get another line because, you know, everybody wants to call between 6 and 8 p.m. And they complain if they get a busy signal, even though you have a clearly tariffed thing on your price list. If you want your own dedicated line, that costs more, and if you share a line, you'll get busy signals. Sorry, they still want. They don't want to pay for their own line, but they never want to get busy signals. And if you're charging $30 a month and you get 10 people for that line, that's $300. If the line costs $1,500 to install, that's 5 months to pay off the cost of the hardware up front. Well, if you're growing, you've had to buy more lines in the meantime, so you never actually get to pay off all the equipment that you've been buying to handle your growth. And when you stop growing, you die. This business can't work. It just doesn't scale. Go ahead.
Thanks. My name's Daniel Dern. I've been writing about the Internet for over a decade. I worked at Bull, Peranek, and Newman during most of the 80s, where I got to learn from people who were actually building and running these things. I'm the author of one of the first of the now 500 or 1,000 Internet books, and I'm finally wrapping up my second edition. I got to be the editor of Internet World for its first year. And despite what it says in my April Fool's Net Guide column, I have no intention of becoming an ISP or a web service provider. Other people may do that, thank you very much. I'm here to hopefully, to bring a few rays of hope in an otherwise gloomy and foggy atmosphere. I tried to come up with some reasons of why small ISPs not only are a good thing, but hopefully why this will help them survive. I thought, to be fair, I'd first start by saying why big national online services and internet providers are a good thing. That's a much shorter list, it turns out, in my opinion. I'm talking about the folks particularly supplying individual user accounts, not the fat pipes. The first answer is they're probably better for getting out-of-town access without paying an additional several dollars an hour. That if you are, say, a Prodigy or CompuServe user, you can use any of their POPs, presumably, without paying more. If you aren't on the road a lot or you're prepared to pay, you know, a couple more bucks a month, then that's not a big advantage. You may have access to custom content or to some content at a better price. If you care about that, that's an advantage. The last is an advantage we all enjoy, whether we are subscribers or not, which is we have this endless supply of coffee coasters and free discs. But again, you don't have to be a member to get that. In fact, I think once you are, they start slicing them out of the poly bags. Now, let's talk about the small ISPs. I've been a user on Software Tool and Dies of the World since I had the pleasure of, quote, leaving BBN in 88 or 89. That was before they had an IP connection to the Internet, thanks to the then extant NSFNet AUP. And for reading news and just getting Usenet, that was fine. The occasional FTP I was able to work around through a borrowed account. Today we can all enjoy internet access at ever decreasing costs or greater power. So people are saying, gee, the internet is still hard to get to. It's like, excuse me? I don't think so. But why is it good? Well, first of all, for a small ISP, in most cases, the internet is their main product, providing access to the other internet sites and services and the local use of email, Usenet, and FTP. So that, as their main product, they're going to pay real attention to it. I mean, if, let's say, America Online's email connection to the internet were, hypothetically, to go down for a week, they would say, you know, that's perhaps not as important. I mean, so the fact that it might say, well, we don't have a spare mail server, or we don't care if gigabytes of mail are piling up elsewhere, that's not as important because it's not their primary product. It's also important, I believe, just from the standpoint of shopping locally. Something very simple, saying, well, I know I can make a phone call or drive and jump up and down on Barry Shine's desk and say, Barry, your service isn't working. I can't go jump up and down on Steve Case's desk without first driving all day. And I couldn't get in either because they have armed guards. The software tool and die has a piranha, but the piranha stays in the tank. I believe the small ISPs are better, likely to have better system administration and user support because, one, I think they get paid better, and two, that again is what they're there for. It's not secondary. This isn't, well, a few unhappy users or a few million unhappy users, big deal. The users are really the customers. The money is not coming from the big advertisers and content providers. As a customer, I'm one of the real sources of money. We also have, again, just the local community. I can't speak for what it's like on, again, the online services, but I know if I have a question about my service or something, I can post to one of my local news groups for Software Tool and Die users only. And we do a lot of problem resolution and problem solving the way that any internal bulletin board will at a company or the same at any other ISP. A lot of the triage is handled by the community. This helps keeps our costs down, foster community, and often get answers faster. We're also more flexible. You know, if some new service comes onto the internet, I'm sure that say Steve Case or somebody in charge of CompuServe, they say, well, should we offer this internet service? Well, let's think about it. Let's have some meetings. We'll do software development. You know, and it may take 3, 6, 9 months to make a decision, modify the software, get support, put it into the newsletter, and roll it out. Whereas if Alexis Rosen wants to let Panix do it or Barry Shine wants to let Software and Tide do it, you have a 24 to 40-hour turnaround to deploy something because you can just make the decision, and you don't have to decide, well, is this bad for the stock price? What will the board say? What will my investors say? You can make a decision based on, well, do we think our customers would like this, and can we afford to do it? Very simple. And you don't have to worry about it scaling to a million customers. Well, if we offer this, are we going to blow out all the cable between here and San Francisco? We also have less commitment to custom front ends. You know, although we're getting Netscape and Microsoft and all these other, you know, big, you know, things globally, the online services and the bigger services have to think more carefully about how this fits into their front window to the internet and their service. The smaller ISPs, subject to constraints of customer support, can say, sure, let's add this, do that. It's okay with us. We can handle it. Certainly one important thing is a smaller ISP can monitor and respond to bozo users better. I'm not saying they necessarily do, but if you have only 2,000 or 20,000 users, you're in a better position of the bandwidth to say, we see 3 bozo users today, let's nuke them. The online services, they just have a longer backlog. And with disposable accounts, by the time you're ready to nuke them, they're long gone. Software Tool and Die, I know, has a simple answer. If there's too much email going in or out, they just charge you. So it says, well, oh, you're getting 10,000 email messages, you're sending them. Well, guess what? They're on your bill. So if you don't like it, go away. Very simple answer. Not fooling. Certainly, since a small ISP is unlikely to have any stock and probably no profit, they're not accountable to people who aren't concerned about performance other than just the financials. And so you don't say, well, we think you're not going to give a good return on your share this month. It's not a problem. You know, we'll be lucky if we can make the payroll, I'm sure. We certainly have a better user behavior, I think. One reason is that the internet is still really not easy to use, despite what you've been told. And the smaller ISPs are somewhat self-selecting in that to get up and rolling, you have to have a little more patience, better control over your blood pressure, and know a few more friends who already are on the net. It's still not quite popping a disc and work on any ISP quite as easily as popping a disc and, ooh, I'm on Prodigy, AOL, CompuServe, Alpha, I'm sailing the internet, oh, I'm having fun. And so the ISPs are keeping better customers, the customers who know what they're doing and who know why they're there and are going to want to stay there. Because there's clearly a lot of thrashing. I mean, arguably, if we look carefully, we have no proof that, quote, big national ISPs are economically viable. I know when I talked with the folks at Prodigy when they were thinking of rolling out internet offerings, and I asked Mike Greenbaum, who has moved on to Bell Atlantic, I said, Mike, do you guys have a business plan to see, you know, are you guys going to at least not lose money doing this? And he said, we believe so. I don't think the jury's come back from that yet. I think if AOL changed its accounting practices to write off customers in a smaller time frame, they'd bleed Red Ink, roll over, and die. I think if the other online services stopped the marketing push and took a snapshot and says, are we making money or losing money, the answers might be kind of depressing. You know, when the phone companies do it, they're going to say, we don't care. We can lose millions of dollars. We did it on interchange. We did it on NCR. We want to hold the customers captives in our tight little hands so we can sell them other stuff. This is the thing I find scary, that it's not a level playing field if your competition is happy to give it away because there's something else they really want instead through it. The question is, will small ISPs survive? I believe so. Certainly the recent survey in BoardWatch magazine turned up like 3,500 ISPs. I'm told there's like 400 in Texas alone. It seems that if you have 1,000 to 10,000 customers, you're not ambitious enough to want to grow nationwide, you can run a business. You won't necessarily get rich. You won't necessarily get weekends off. You won't necessarily get a Ferrari or a Porsche or have the time to drive it. But there's a good chance that you can run a business that pays for itself and where hopefully people enjoy working and delivers adequate service. And armed against that, you know, AT&T can come and get the other 99 million customers. If you keep your 1 or 10,000 customers that are happy to be there, you as a small ISP can survive, and I, as a customer who likes to shop locally, can have some place to go. Lastly, I believe the small ISPs remain flexible. When you start asking for all the specials, oh, I want a mailing list, I want a funky web page, the big services can't respond that fast, and they're not interested in pleasing the little customers. Their primary goal, I think, is to, yes, New York Times, yes, Mercury Journal, we'd love to give you exactly what you want, because those are the big customers. My friend Rob Raich at the Internet Company says to the national services, people like me are not the customer, we're the product. You know, that we are the product being delivered to the advertisers and the big content owners, and they are the customers. I can't prove that, but it often feels that way, that somehow I'm a piece of the internet that's being sold. The online services came in 3 to 5 years ago and said, oh, the internet. First, no, it's no threat. Nobody cares. Then it's, oh, we could sell more time. We could just sell more internet hours at $2 to $6 an hour because the internet is a rich natural resource waiting to be harvested. Well, the wheel is turned, and as many of us predicted, in selling the internet, the online services have sown their own doom because they've had to cut prices. They've had to offer things that they can't control and yet, as you've heard, are expected to be liable for. And the users are seeing that you can get it cheaper elsewhere. Now AT&T and their brethren are coming in to turn the wheel once again and put the screws to the metal. Will ISPs survive? I certainly hope so, because I think it's important as part of the tradition for free speech, community access, and the ability to get something where we need it, not just to the metropolitan concentrations, but to the rural areas, the suburbs, the communities of people who would not otherwise afford access. And so I hope they will survive. As I said, I believe they will, because there are price points where they can afford to stay in service, as long as the lawyer bills and the cost of peering over everything and say, gee, is this okay, don't drive them out of business. There may be some more changes. I suspect we are going to see the small ISPs begin to federate to get some scaling for legal representation, for other software, and for whatever else is needed to make sure they survive. But I certainly believe they can, and again, I certainly believe they should. Do not let the big companies be our only access to what began as a great empowering tool. If they do, we'll have only one recourse, to reinvent a new internet and start from scratch again, which would take about 48 hours to do. And I'm ready, and I know a lot of other people are. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan, you are living in a dream world. And if it's such a good business, why don't you start one?
Because I don't want to. I didn't say it was a great business. I already have white hairs.
Why do you think large companies are such a threat to the internet? That's sort of what I was hearing.
Because the market believes that they're the right answer.
Why is that a threat? I mean, why is that a problem if the internet access is offered by large companies?
Well, let's think of, if an internet is such a good thing, they say, well, what do we want? We want to do things that we can control. Well, maybe we don't want to offer Usenet because we can't control it and there's too much liability there. Maybe we want to censor it. Maybe we don't care as much about email because we have to administer it and back it up and be responsible for it. Maybe we want to just have Internet Lite, web pages and FTP files. And they suddenly start skimming the cream based on what's easy and safe and where they can sell advertising and use
well,
to bootstrap other services.
But it's directly contrary to experience. The large companies are increasingly offering more and more services, not less and less services. And if AOL stopped offering email tomorrow, they would basically stop having a viable service tomorrow.
Why don't we take it to the floor?
Okay. My name is Colette Silvestri. I am from the Senate Democratic Research in the state of Pennsylvania. And when I started in 91 with the Internet, study of the Internet, what I kept notes of was not so much, I mean, I kept notes of the technologies. I traveled around to learn all of, not only just learn them, but learn them, that I can produce it almost like, you know, write home pages, etc. However, what I kept was a very important notebook, and that important notebook was, who understands what? And that understands what is turning out to be the most critical problem. So since 91, I kept notes of how many states were getting online, how many people were duplicating their lines, how many legislators understood the technologies, how many legislators were pursuing, or congressmen or whatnot, pursuing people and bashing the internet because they didn't understand, how many internet service providers, and I want you guys all know this, we are accountable to our state. I'd call up because at that time we didn't have mailboxes for the internet. They couldn't grant to us in Pennsylvania. They had it, but they didn't release it yet. So some of the senators or legislators had to go outside. So we call AOL Prodigy. Now we need a bill to turn over to our clerks. I mean physical, paper, that's all I understand. You guys must understand, we have to be accountable. We're working in a world, you guys are ahead, you're flying, let's have DigiCast, etc. But please stop for 1 second and walk through those halls and look at that paper, okay? We must turn that bill in, and we must be accountable. So they said, well, tell AOL to go away. Well, we can't take that. So I had to hang up. Call Prodigy. Tell Prodigy to go away, you know. So we looked and looked and looked until we found someone that would give us, we had to cry and get a receipt, okay? But that is the first problem, okay, I had to get hooked up. The second problem I found was I would go upstairs and the number one thing, remember this when you're doing business. Kids, tell to me in one sentence or get out. My time is limited, wait. And you're there, okay, get the kid out. So it turns out they're scared. I mean, this is altering law, okay? I'm looking at this, and it is altering law. Number two, you're playing liar's dice with them. You'll look at them and they'll say, gee, Brian, this is wonderful. I totally understand what the hell they're saying. Okay, so they really must, they're playing liar's dice because they don't want to admit they don't know the technology. Thirdly, don't just demonstrate for them. Do not just demonstrate for them. It is, they can't go back to school. They don't have the time to go back to school. And if an aide tries to explain, okay, this is not a simple let the experts handle it type thing, because now this is them on the line. And this is literally on the line. That is your problem. You're dealing with a world that has to be educated. The second problem I found was to build it is you must help us build that bridge. My thing is to bring in techies, pure techies. And one guy was, you know, just standing there, you know, and the legislators looked at me like, oh my God, what is that? I think, this is your future. You must work with this man. You must understand what they are saying. And they have a totally different world of jargon. We must look at that jargon in law, so we may interpret law. So they were scared of that. So you must, the second thing is you must help build the bridge.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
I'm trying to say this is very important that I can get this across. The last one, what you get through to us will define the law. And what Prodigy said right there, this is not just a simple phone call. It's not as simple as a phone call. I understood this. This may be the last hole open for free speech. And I understood that as well. And that is what I was trying to explain to them. You will not get your definition of law to save yourselves until you get to those who make the law. And they must fully understand a working, this is not just an aid telling, it has to be a workable understanding of the technology or you will not achieve it because you will either be the store or the open street. Because when the copyright laws come down, you're going to be hitting hard. Secondly, if you're the street, okay, then they'll say, author, protect thyself. And everybody secludes their, they you know, build a fort around their own site. So this is basically, I just want to tell you this, a person who had to sit there and tell AOL and Prodigy and other people to go away, you're up there, boys. I'm proud of you, but please come back and get us. That's what I have to say.
Thank you.
Watch out for this guy. He's a real troublemaker.
I don't like his hair.
Is this the kind of guy we're going to have to work with?
Your system is toast, Bruce.
I was at a bigwig computer conference last week, and I heard from the horse's own mouth, so to speak, the attitudes about internet service in the future from the really large companies. And there was Will Hurst from At Home, who gave a little five-minute lecture called The Miracle of Clean IP, who in no way wants to do anything other than simply sell IP. I mean, he is not interested in doing anything else. He wants to make no restrictions on anything else. He just wants to make a clean highway for people to move data across. Even more interesting, believe it or not, was the fellow who's head of AT&T WorldNet Systems, who was talking about the conflict between local exchange carriers who have the wire that runs to your house and the long-distance providers who want to provide flat-rate internet service. And currently, I don't know if, how many of you know this, but the internet is exempted under the requirement to provide access charges from the LEX to the long-distance providers because it's a experimental service. That won't last. And there's going to be a very interesting debate between, I mean, it'll be this like sumo wrestlers trying to slug it out. Who actually ends up paying for the local loop connections that these long-distance providers want to offer? Now, the fellow from AT&T was very interested because he said that
the Internet would drive a change in technology at the phone company level, in the switch even, which would move from circuit switch data connections being able to be purchased to packet switch data. And so I think we have absolutely nothing to fear from any of these large companies about providing Internet service, because the thing they want to provide is connections, just the same way they provide the phone network. And in fact, the fact that we've got the phone companies on their side rather than TCI and Viacom cable is a huge win. Because the phone companies want to provide connections, and they do not in any way want to provide restrictions on content. It's not in their best interest to have restrictions on content.
They don't have restrictions on content now.
No, but exactly. So anyway, if any of you want to comment on what's going to happen there.
Let's just note that, as far as I understand it, AT&T has filed to also become a local phone access provider in all states. So this master not-so-secret plan is to go around the competition by entering their home turf.
I think it's interesting, too. We may see a kind of inversion where the Internet has been running over the phone network, and we're going to see more voice services running over the Internet.
I'm more concerned not so much with who's providing the pipe and who's providing the straight connection, but for the future of the Internet, who's going to be providing the content, especially with relation to the new content coming down the road and what the copyright is going to do to this. I know already in the online community, content is getting very pricey, which is part of the reason that we're doing more and more with the Internet. Mr. Case, I kind of view as the George Steinbrenner of the content world. There are some tremendous fees being thrown around for content providers to come on an exclusive basis. Quite frankly, fees that I think a number of other players can't possibly match. But I do think that I'm concerned that everybody new coming to the table is interested in offering the pipe, but I'm hearing precious little from providers that are coming to the table and are willing to add the content that is going to build the value of the Internet.
But Brian, you told me that one of Prodigy's secrets for success is to become a huge web hosting service. So you guys are going to offer the content.
We do intend to, but there are very few others out there who are looking to do it. They are more looking to partner up in exclusive content deals.
Bruce, what's the future of the clean IP business?
Don't look at me. I do want to add something briefly. I may have been a little incoherent earlier because I'm a little hungover. And
you were the most coherent.
I'm still hungover, so I'm still going to be incoherent. But basically, I think the only real point I wanted to make is that I hear a lot of concern from people about big corporations, and I see a lot of hand-wringing and agonizing over would-be monopolists. Big corporations are not the problem and are not the threat. Corporations want to sell you things. The corporations are interested in making money. The government is interested in power, and when they tell you they're going to provide universal service and they're going to protect the elderly from, you know, to have a lifeline and all sorts of wonderful things they're going to do for you, what it's really about is appointing a bunch of lawyers who do not have a clue to oversee the threat to small companies.
Yeah, Prodigy won't call up and leave a message on your phone machine that somebody's been posting pornographic files with your account. Small companies violate privacy much more than big companies. Big companies are too busy.
Well, I want to just add real quick to that, though. To the extent that there is a clean IP future and there's a big business in clean IP, that means that's where the big business will be, and I tend to think that we may be going that way. But as a lawyer, I keep coming back to this question of who's going to be accountable. And if the big business is in nothing but the conduit game, then I think that our laws are going to move towards trying to figure out ways to make people who are in the conduit game accountable, because when the people who are providing the content happen to be people who are doing it anonymously or who have no assets and resources and aren't able to provide the remedies that people want when they do actually write them in, and we talk a lot about how horrible it is that people can get sued online, but let's face it, you can hurt people online and there should be some remedy when that happens. And if it is the fact that the money and the wallet is at the conduit level, then I think that there is going to be a very pronounced movement with judges and legislators to make those people liable for other people's content. And in fact, that's what I think we're seeing now. So clean IP may be clean from a technical perspective, but eventually from a legal perspective, it's going to, I think, assume some of the burdens that that traditional publishers have presumed all along, and that may not make it as good an economic model later on.
I think it's curious that Will Hurst said he was going to offer clean IP because I know they're hiring a huge number of editors to produce online content. So I don't know what direction they're going.
Thanks. Don't trust her.
Enough heckling of the question.
Hi, I'm Beth Rosenberg. I'm a journalist and a writer. I talk a lot about internet issues. And I just wanted to make a few comments about the role of small internet providers in a world that's, you know, increasingly become, you know, conglomerates, and how, you know, ISPs are doing this fundamentally new business in a world where all little mom and pop things are being shoved over to the side. For large companies, and I am intimately involved in VineyardNet much more than I would have chosen to be originally. And we've had some strange issues just with the issues of dealing with SprintNet and dealing with AT&T, and at the same time having a modem bank in our right below our dining room, and if the prime hours are between 6 and 8 p.m., which is our, you know, presumably our dinner time, and you hear all the modems go off in the basement, and then you hear the phones in the basement go off because the modems are down and somebody's complaining, and you can't get away with that. You know, you're living with that all the time, and at the same time, the large companies, you're just a stinky little person, and they don't care about you, and they don't really care about your service, and, you know, they're going to screw you up. AT&T has, every single time we've tried to have new phone lines put in,
9X.
Is it 9X? Thank you, dear. Every time, you know, we've tried to have new phone lines, 9X has come in and put the lines in backwards. They put them in the wrong place. You know, they have to get called at and yelled at, and they come back and they do it wrong again. You know, we're just like these annoying little people who decide to have 100 phone lines put in their basement and they have to shut down the street for us. You know, they don't like doing that. But I think that the most dramatic example of, you know, how when you have this small ISP and your customers really depend on you, they don't know that there's all these larger things going on. All they notice is that their service is not there and they can't dial up, and it's your fault. So 2 months ago or so, when we were in California for the week, SprintNet went down for 2 days for a couple different reasons. And Simpson had this little pager that had all these numerical codes on it that said whether it was our machine that went down, whether it was SprintNet that went down, whether it was SetNet that went down, whether it was the router that was down. And it was going up all the time, you know, like constantly, 4 or 5 times a day. And, you know, there was that experience that we're on the other side of the country. This is our little business, and every single customer that we have is frantically trying to get in touch with us, and there's nothing we can do. And
leave your pager home.
You know, a couple people actually switched to the competitor because the competitor was not using SprintNet. And that's something that and of course this is not Simpson's real job. Okay. You know, if you're thinking of running a small ISP, if you have one, please remember, you know, please tell your customers that it's not necessarily you. There's a bigger world out there and they need to know.
I have a question, which is, are universities ISPs? Kind of rhetorical, but before coming here, there's sort of a tendency to think of ourselves as campus computer service providers. And yet all the services we're providing are the same services the ISPs are providing now. And in fact, we are in some sense in competition with ISPs because some of our users might go to them to get to our machines and vice versa. So I want to comment on.
That's a great question. And, you know, it's, not sure how to answer it, and in fact, I think that that's part of the problem, is that we're not sure how to answer it. And, you know, and in fact, I think that unfortunately, they're going to ask you to answer it as universities, and depending on the circumstances, your answer is going to either get you in trouble or save your skin. I don't know whether that question is something that the law is going to contemplate. I mean, it certainly changes things like from a First Amendment perspective, because if you're a public university or state school, it makes a difference. I know this, that a lot of people get their access through universities and to the extent, you know, college towns, in fact, most people get their access in through that, because it's free for them as students. And I think that it's an extremely important question, and it's probably unfortunate that we ignored that to the extent that we did, because there is a third player out there, and they have a whole different set of motivations and a whole different set of constraining factors, and they also have this sense that they're trying to do something good and not just make money. At least some of them do. And so I think that it's worth more discussion. I'm just not sure that it's happening.
I think it's worth noting that in Washington, from a copyright owner's perspective, in the discussions that are going on in that area, the universities are represented, and it's a very interesting and very thorny issue. But I can tell you that from the standpoint of the copyright owners represented around the table, that if it comes to infringing material, if they cannot identify where it's particularly coming from, if it's somewhere sitting on a university server, they're going to be looking at you.
I think that universities should get out of the business of providing email to their students. I think it is not something that universities should be doing. Universities do not provide phone service to their students unless they live in the dorms. Universities, they don't provide phone service to off-campus students. They don't fund student newspapers, with very few exceptions. And I think that there's an inherent conflict there between what a information service provider does and what a university does. I don't think that's going to work out.
They do have libraries, right? And we all expect them to have libraries.
Yeah.
And to the extent that this thing is replacing the libraries, it would be tough to say wipe that out of the educational setting in our universities. I mean, I understand certainly what you're saying, but it's not an easy problem.
Yeah, but they run libraries, but they don't run they don't run off-campus postal services.
Right.
My name is Pam Samuelson, and I wanted simply to reinforce what the gentleman from Prodigy was saying about the importance of understanding and getting involved with the copyright issues, because they do affect freedom of expression and your privacy. And I think the example that you gave is precisely the kind of example that people in this community really need to understand. If the online service providers are going to be strictly liable for every piece of infringing material, it does put them in a situation where they're supposed to monitor everything that goes in and out. And it does seem to me that both invades privacy of users and also chills expression that people might want to communicate with one another. And it does seem to me that now is the time to do this. And this is only one of a set of examples of free expression and privacy issues that really come up in the copyright context. And it's amazing to me how little kind of energy the community has been putting behind sort of some of these digital copyright issues, because in my view they have a potential to affect community far beyond the Communications Decency Act, which I agree also affects this community. So I mostly wanted to sort of provide reinforcement for that. Also to say that there is an organization of organizations, it's called the Digital Future Coalition. I'm on the steering committee of that particular organization. It's a coalition of 27 organizations, and it's a real umbrella of kind of mixed bag of people who are really concerned about copyright for the future. It includes library associations, it includes consumer organizations, it includes the American Council of Learned Societies and the Communications and Computer Industry Association, and I would be glad to talk to anyone here who is part of an organization that would like to link up with us or at least find out more about what we're doing. I also can offer you the email address of the person.
Do you have an URL for that?
Well, we have a web page, but the person to contact is named Adam Eisgrau. His email address is ame@alawash.org, and I really hope that people here will get energized, because it's really our future that's at stake. Thank you.
I think with the fact that it's unlikely that we're going to see anything in the way of copyright legislation on this issue this year, we have an opportunity to get it right the first time. And I think that's why it's important for everybody that if you have an opportunity to talk to your congressman and journalists out in the audience to get involved and let your opinions be heard. We do have an opportunity to do something very unlike the way the CBA went down.
My name is Chuck Morrison. I'm a lawyer in San Francisco. One of my clients is the Netscape Communications Corporation. My work for them is First Amendment privacy and government affairs. I've never met Mr. Eck, but I've shared endless conference calls with him and others in fruitless attempts to defeat the CDA. I thought I'd give a very extreme illustration of the point that he was making, that we can't be parents to children and that we can't be arbiters of who invades copyright and we can't be judges of who defames whom and we can't be controllers of the behavior of people who use our systems. As of last week, we were getting 48 million hits a day on our web server. Netscape has 700 employees. It's not all it did. When I went to work for it, it had 100 and was getting 4 million hits a day, and it's now 700 employees and 48 hits, million hits a day. That's more than a billion a month. According to my math on my little yellow pad, if we were required to be daddy to the minors and judges of the infringers and arbiters of the defamers and so forth, that would require each one of our employees to make 68,571 judgment calls a day. Now, I'm sorry, but those employees are busy keeping a half step ahead of the sinister Bill Gates and plugging holes in code and coming out with beta 17 and 0, and they have no time to do that. And if the legislature, state or federal, ever imposes on a web server like Netscape the obligation to do the things that Mr. Eck set forth, our only solution is going to be to turn off the servers, period. The other comment I wanted to make was to depress Messrs. Garfinkel and Dern even further. The legislatures aren't just after the big boys. They're after the little boys, too, and girls. And I can give you no better example than a bill that was just faxed to me here, and I just learned of 48 hours ago that was introduced in the California legislature. It's AB 2833 or something like that. I've got a copy of it for those interested. Here's what it says. It defines bulletin boards as anything that charges a fee for access and uses a computer. And it says that you've got to register with the state's attorney general, that you've got to pay a, yes, it covers Prodigy as well as Mr. Garfinkel. It requires a payment of a $50 fee every year for the privilege of operating a board. It requires for all boards, including small boards, that there be a separate open voice telephone line during reasonable business hours. It makes it illegal to operate without complying with these provisions of the law. It makes each penalty, each violation a fine of $2,500. It allows the judge to string those fines consecutively depending on the circumstances. It authorizes the county councils and the attorney general to sue civilly to collect money, and here's the kicker, all the money goes into the county trough. So it's a bounty hunter bill, essentially, by which our counties are going to fund themselves at the expense of BBS.
Do you think that bill is similar to bills requiring the registration of printing presses?
I do. I think it's wildly unconstitutional. And I'm glad that we don't fit the definition of a bulletin board, but you guys do.
I was going to say, you know, we thought that in Texas, too, that it would be wildly, you know, problematic and that no one would do it. The problem is that the people who drafted that bill, I would guess, never thought about printing presses there, because they're using a different metaphor. They're thinking about access, and they're thinking about things like telephones, and they have no problem telling the telephone companies to register, and that issue's a dead issue. And so it's really just a question of refocusing them on the differences between the people they're used to pulling into their regulatory scheme and the people that the First Amendment says they can't pull in to their scheme. And if they don't, if they're not made aware of those differences, then they don't even understand that there is a problem with what they're doing.
I agree with you, but that's the benign view of things. Suppose you're a little bit paranoid. Once you register something, there's a purpose of registration, and sometimes other things follow registration. And currently, the only people in California that have to register with the AG are sex offenders, if that'll give you any guide. What they have in mind after they register you, I don't know.
But it's
time to gang up that fight.
You know, I was thinking that in this room we may be coming up with a new cottage industry that may be more financially advantageous than running an online service or an internet service. We could actually go out and offer ourselves as designated detainees to these various providers, that in return for a fairly large stipend, we can be the ones that the courts go after and put in jail.
I think that's an excellent idea.
The designated hostage.
You mean Prodigy would take the fall for VineyardNet?
For the right price, maybe.
Well, we'd be happy to sell you all of our customers if you would simply put a dial-up on Martha's Vineyard.
Perhaps you could offer a discount to the users if they offer to be in the hostage pool.
Brian, I always thought that's what parents were for, designated detainees. I want to pose a question in the form of a hypothetical, which was in part motivated by Bruce's statement that there really should be no FCC. I'm going to be admittedly somewhat pro-regulatory here, at least in my suggestion. Here's the hypothetical. Lots of local phone companies are itching to figure out how to get into the internet access provider business. That's not hypothetical. That's true. They want to compete with you guys and just, you know, snuff you out. I'm talking about local phone companies here who have not made the splash that AT&T and MCI and others have tried to make yet. So the local phone companies realize that they have this neat, if underappreciated, service called ISDN, which they currently charge somewhere between $30 and $200 a month for, but really probably cost them about $4 a month. They've got tariffs for this service. You pay out the nose for it in general. It's probably a pretty good service over which to offer residential internet access, at least given the current state of technology and the absence of fiber optic cables running to our navels today. So your local phone company decides to Simpson come to the Vineyard because they like it there.
Wait, Danny, let me cut you off here.
No. But
we asked them to come,
but
they refused.
Well, you're a unique kind of businessman who seems to be trying to run away from his customers, let's take some. maybe I'll focus this on Bruce. 9X decides they want to compete with you, and they want to say that not only is their service going to be cheaper, but it's going to be quite a bit faster and based on digital access. And whereas when you want to offer your customers access at ISDN speeds, they've got to pay the 30 to whatever rate it is in New York City. But they're going to offer it to their customers bundled with whatever else you need for IP service at $4 a month plus $1 for IP routing. How do you feel about that? Who do you go to when that happens?
Basically, I don't believe, first of all, that the intent of regulation or the principle behind it is to protect competitors. It's to protect the consumers. So I'm not going to go to anyone and say, that isn't fair. They're putting me out of business. I think the important thing is that there be alternatives. There be some form of competition. There's no such thing as a perfect market.
And who's going to make there be some form of competition?
I think if the telecommunications market were deregulated, it would probably take some time to undo the damage wrought by the monopoly, the legal monopoly that we've had for some 60-odd years. But the fact of the matter is there are alternatives to the phone company's infrastructure. And perhaps they're not actually fully adequate at this time, but I believe if the market was deregulated that would change. There's possibilities for cable systems, for wireless, and
I'm not aware of anything in current law that prevents any of those companies from offering competing access services.
Well, I'm sorry,
I don't think there's anything in current law that prevents any of those companies from offering competing access services. I just don't see them doing it anytime soon as a practical matter.
Well, in fact, there was a trial in Cambridge that I reported on rather extensively to bundle internet service with cable, and it failed because these cable modems really don't work. And anybody here who thinks cable modems work, you know, you're wrong. They don't work in the field. And I'm counting, though, Danny, on wireless to make a really big push. As soon as this PCS stuff starts starting up, you're going to be able to get basically 100 megabit to a gigabit per second wireless anywhere on your block. And cost-wise, it doesn't cost a lot more than ISDN for the companies to offer that. And it has the added advantage that you can move the computer in your house without having to have somebody come in and lay a new wire. So my guess is that cable modems and fiber to the home, all that is dead technology, and we're going to be seeing low-power, high-bandwidth digital service, and you're nodding because you agree with me on this. And the beautiful thing about the wireless environment is it allows competition. Clearly a growth pattern for VineyardNet is we get out of internet service and we get into phone service. But hopefully we just go out of business because it's not fun, as Jeff said.
Well, I really admire your business ethic. I do. I guess the point I'm trying to make in a roundabout way is that I do think we have a very long and I think very messy transition process from a highly, highly monopolized telecommunications marketplace today in which there is effectively only one option for access to the net or access to anything else in a bidirectional or certainly in a digital way. And that before we all trash the FCC, we should think about the kind of constructive role that the FCC may have in getting us from here, which is admittedly a mess, to there, which is a point where we don't need an enormous regulatory infrastructure to make the market function properly.
They got us into this mess, so they're not going to get us out of it. Well, make them go away, and the market will take care of it eventually. And it'll happen sooner with a free market than it will under any sort of regulatory oversight. I mean, no regulatory commission is going to willingly put themselves out of business. They're going to figure out some way to justify continuing to regulate the market.
Huh? Well, we should remember why the FCC came in the first place, and that's because there were radio stations broadcasting on top of each other, cacophony of voices. This valuable public resource is going to seed. And if you were in New York City in like the 1890s, there were places where you couldn't see the sky because there were so many competing telegraph companies that had put cables up everywhere. It was a complete mess. There are reasons to have some sort of regulatory rubric, but
this has got to be. We've got to wrap up quickly.
I'm Saul Tenenbaum. I administer systems for Tufts University, I find Simpson's comment that I should get out of the email business very provocative, and I want to know how I can do that. Simpson will run an ISP in your city.
The University of California, Berkeley, is actually contracting out its dial-up service to Netcom. Huh. And why should a university be in the business of running unprofitable modem banks?
I think the environment is a lot more complicated than you may realize. Universities not only have libraries, but they run radio stations, they run TV stations. They do, in fact, subsidize newspapers. At our university, we've just wired our dorms, and incoming freshmen have better connectivity in their home than I do, and that many of us do. And in fact, I have students who want to become ISPs from their dorm room.
Without telling them.
We've written the rules so they can't charge for it, so that but in essence, they are, you know, if they in fact want to do this, they are subsidized competition to the commercial carriers, and it's getting to be an extremely confusing world.
I'm sorry, I'm getting this from the.
I'd like to close with one quick thought, which is we're talking about the ISPs and internet service as if it were a given that it's a good and useful thing. I'd like to suggest we may have saturated that audience, and when we say here is something that requires $500 to $5,000 to tap into as a user, and where the new users may not necessarily know whether it's useful, we have to also ask, what are we trying? Is there something that, is there a there that they're offering some access to? And we have to start asking about that as well.
I'd like to thank all the panelists for stepping in.